The readings this morning are a bit longer, thicker, rich. Sermon is shorter. And the first reading comes from a stellar online essay. It's the new world. We don't have books all the time. Online essay by Tom Englehart, written 2 years ago on his blog, Tom Dispatch. The title is, Where Have All the Protests Gone?
In the Vietnam era, demonstrations started small and built slowly over the years towards the massive, in Washington, in cities around the country, and then on campuses nationwide. In those years, as anger, anxiety, and outrage mounted, militancy rose, and yet the range of anti-war demonstrators grew to include groups as diverse as businessmen against the war. And large numbers of ever more vociferous Vietnam vets, often just back from the war itself, almost exactly the opposite pattern, the vets aside, has occurred with Iraq. The pre-war demonstrations were monstrous, instantaneously gigantic, at home and abroad. Millions of people grasped just where we were going in late 2002 and early 2003, and grasped as well that an American-occupied Iraq would lead to disaster and death galore. The New York Times, usually notoriously unimpressed with demonstrations, referred to the massed demonstrators then as the second superpower on a previously one superpower planet. And it did look, as the Times headlines went, as if there were a new power in the streets. But here was the strange thing. As the lone superpower faltered, as the administration and the Pentagon came to look ever less super, ever less victorious, ever less powerful, so did that other superpower. Discouragement of a special sort seemed to set in. Initially, perhaps, that the invasion had not been stopped, and that in Washington, no one in a tone-deaf administration even seemed to be listening. Still, through the first years of the war, on occasion, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators could be gathered in one spot to march massively, even cheerfully. These were crowds filled with first-timers who were proud to tell you so, and increasingly with the families of soldiers stationed in Iraq or Afghanistan, or of soldiers who had died there, and even sometimes with some of the soldiers themselves, as well as contingents of vets from the Vietnam era, older now, grayer, but still vociferously anti-war. However, over the years, unlike in the Vietnam era, the demonstrations shrank, and somehow the anxiety, the anger, though it remained suspended somewhere in the American ether, stopped manifesting itself so publicly, even as the war went on and on. Or, put another way, perhaps the anger went deeper and turned inward, like a scouring agent. Perhaps it went all the way into what was left of an American belief system, into despair about the unresponsiveness of the government, with paralyzing effect. As another potentially more disastrous war with Iran edges into sight, the response has been limited largely to what might be called the professional demonstrators. The surge of hope, of visual creativity, of spontaneous interaction, of the urge to turn out, that arose in those pre-war demonstrations now seemed so long gone, replaced by a more powerful sense that nothing anyone could do mattered in the least. When it comes to the Vietnam analogy domestically, the question that still hangs in the air is whether, as in the later years of the Vietnam era, the soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as here at home, will take matters into their own hands. Whether, as with Vietnam, in the end, Iraq and Iran will be left to the vets of this war and their families and friends, or to no one at all.
And the second reading is the most excellent poem, A Few Questions, Not Entirely Political, by the longtime Quaker poet, Jean Lohman.
Slamming into us, the wind pushed our placards off the iron railing outside the federal building. Wanting words I could stand by, these made me uneasy, a strident, facile blame, the public appeal to guilt. After the vigil, riding home on the bus, I try to resist a temptation to sadness. The precarious balancing acts of our lives leave much undone. By not so much as the weight of one raindrop could we lessen the misery of the world. A fat passenger settling into the next plush seat squeezes me close to the window. I feel like a fugitive, the questions from my faithful and radical friends spinning the tires on the rain-slick freeway. What rouses us finally? Why choose Bosnia and fail Guatemala? Why no attention to years of massacre in El Salvador? Why relief for Somalia, not the Sudan, Chechnya, China, Cuba? We could name other places, always, and closer home there's politics to consider, choices, the terrible complex dilemmas. We can't fix everything. But how do we answer each other, or the starving and tortured, the broken and passed over? The children whose cries didn't reach us or came from the wrong place, wrong time, and were never loud enough.
Often, when I was a child, my mother would call up from the basement and ask for something she needed in the upstairs pantry. She would be downstairs making a huge cauldron of broth in the lower kitchen, something found in most every Italian-American home here in the States. Mark, could you bring me down another onion? I would say, sure, Ma. And then I would look in the pantry for an onion. I know what an onion looks like. Roundish, kind of yellow and tan, papery skin. So I would look through the bin where the onions and the potatoes were kept. No onion. I would call down and tell her that there were no onions. She would grumble, and then I would hear her coming up the steps, and then she herself would go to the pantry, look in the bin, and pull out an onion. See, she would say, clearly annoyed, there is too an onion. Of course, it wasn't what I was looking for. It was red, almost purplish. It had no papery skin, but was as shiny as a Christmas tree ornament. I didn't see it because I didn't know onions could be purple red. I thought onions were only yellow tan. And on that day, I began to learn an important lesson. You might find what you are looking for if you don't have a preconceived notion of what it looks like. If you know what you want in advance, you might not see what is right in front of your face if what you are looking for doesn't resemble what you imagine. So recently, when a wonderful woman in this congregation was talking with me, she took me off guard in the middle of the conversation when she said to me, I just don't know what's going on in this church. It's changed so much. Back in the old days, we were a lot more socially concerned than we are now. Now there's hardly any social justice work going on at all anymore. I was totally confused when I heard these words. I was immediately thinking of all the work led by members of the Social Justice Committee, which meets all the time, the Empty Bowls program, the Guest at Your Table program, the letter writing. I was thinking of how many marched in the Pride Parade in June. I was thinking about how 250 of us showed up at a BREAD meeting to put pressure on urban leaders for positive change. I was thinking of all the work Alice Rathburn does to encourage people to join BREAD research teams so that our justice work is grounded in cold, hard fact. And I was thinking about the many trips our own children take down to the Hocking Hills with Jacques Angelino, where they confront poverty face-to-face, a life-changing event in many cases. I thought of all of these things and 100 more, and I was baffled by her statement. But instead of expressing my bafflement, I did the same thing, and I asked a question, always a wiser approach than leaping to conclusions. What do you mean? I asked her, and she said, we used to join peace marches all the time back in the 60s and 70s, and now we don't, even though there is another war going on. And immediately I remembered the onion story. Peace marches for this wonderful woman, bread for me. They look different, like a yellow onion and a red onion look different. But just as both onions will successfully season the broth, so both a peace march and hard work on a research team are expressions of the deep social justice concerns of this whole congregation. Now, somebody could argue that one thing is more basic than the other, but I don't buy such arguments. I would rather agree with Martin Luther King Jr., who made it clear that any dream of peace without a commitment toward economic justice tends toward feel-good romanticism. So for me, they always go together. In fact, No one has the strength to pry them apart. Now, it was clear last week when Nathan played Where Have All the Flowers Gone as the interlude between the readings and the sermon that a lot of folks seem to have known the words because, without any prompting from me or anybody else, they joined along and sang, even though there were no words printed in the order of service. Old Pete Seeger song from the 60s and early 70s, the Vietnam War days. But when I looked around, and you kind of get a nice vantage from up here, when I look around and I saw who it was who was singing, I noted that they were almost all of the same generation, give or take 10 or 15 years. This was a song sung during those well-remembered protests during the Vietnam War, a song deep in the bones of very many people here. But there were plenty of others, quite a bit younger, who did not know the words to the song from memory. Maybe they had never even sung it before. Now, the Vietnam War was not the very first war that people protested against. And that anti-war song of Pete Seeger was hardly the first anti-war song. Nor do songs pointing out the harsh realities of war belong to liberals and progressives and Unitarian Universalists alone during the 60s or any other generation. When I was attending a Catholic church when I was younger, we used to sing Where Have All the Flowers Gone during Mass. And we're going to sing it again here today in this congregation. So it doesn't belong to any particular group of people. But it is a song known a lot more by one generation than other generations. Yet the song itself is something that has changed. Not only did I discover two alternative sets of words to the song, they are similar, but there's some significant changes, and I don't know which one is the one that Pete Seeger originated. I couldn't figure that out. But the song itself was not created by Pete Seeger, whichever version he wrote, in a vacuum. As a matter of fact, Seeger's words to the song were an adaptation of a very old Ukrainian folk song, which was quoted by the Nobel laureate Mikhail Sholokhov in his award-winning novel, Tikhi Don, in Russian, or Quiet Flows the Don, written in 1934. The Don, as some of you may know, is one of the great rivers in Russia, and Sholokhov's novel is one of the great novels of the 20th century, and it well earned the Nobel Prize. Seeger read these words and then generalized them a bit, to be sure. The original words are at the top of your orders of service if you want to look at them, translated into English. But please, back in 1934, long before Vietnam, back when that was still Indochina, Sholokhov was just as aware, as he made clear in his novel, that war is hell, as Pete Seeger was during the Vietnam era. And he was just as aware as General Sherman was when he first uttered those famous words, war is hell, here in Columbus, Ohio, back in 1880. And just as many Vietnam vets confirmed that war is hell, even before they came back and were forgotten by everybody else. Being for peace and against war is not something invented in the 1960s. It's been going on since long before Rome fell. Songs, protests, everything. Even the Hebrew scriptures. The text we read earlier is 2,700 years old, urge us to beat our swords into plows and convert our spears into pruning hooks, because farming is far better than going to war. According to Tom Engelhardt in our first reading, we actually did march for peace and against the war in Iraq at the beginning. It was very much like during the Vietnam era, he says, but it did not stay the same. For Washington has been a different place for the last 20 years or so than it was in the 1960s. Tom Engelhardt uses the kindest word possible, calling our first 21st century leaders tone deaf. I can think of other words. Again, he reminds us that there were plenty of marches and protests at the beginning of the war. I preached against the Iraqi war many times, in fact, although not everyone agreed with me and told me so in letters or otherwise. But Engelhardt notices a difference between the Vietnam era and our era, and I think what he says is a very important insight. He writes, however, over the years, unlike in the Vietnam era, the demonstrations shrank. And somehow the anxiety, the anger, though it remained suspended somewhere in the American ether, stopped manifesting itself so publicly, even as the war went on and on and on. Or put it another way, perhaps the anger went deeper and turned inward, like a scouring agent. Perhaps it went all the way into what was left of an American belief system, into despair about the unresponsiveness of the government, and with a paralyzing effect. Quaker poet Jean Lohman brings up that paralysis powerfully in her poem. It's a paralysis, she suggests, caused by the fact that we're now living in the information age. We are just overwhelmed with information, not just by the events in Iraq, however we feel about that particular war. The horror of war, I hope, is clear to everyone of goodwill, no matter what their political bent. But there are so many wars. And it's not just war which brings hell to the earth either, but the pathetic government response to Katrina, for example, the growing climate crisis, the recorded torture of the last decade, and the 1,000 unjust imprisonments at the expense of human rights exposed by Amnesty International. And even if we ignore all the rest of that, how, I wonder, are we to weigh which wars to protest against? They're all equally awful. What rouses us, finally, the poet asks with brutal clarity. What rouses us? Why choose Bosnia and fail Guatemala? Why no attention to years of massacre in El Salvador? Why relief for Somalia and not the Sudan? Chechnya, China, Cuba? We could name other places always, and closer to home, there's politics to consider. Choices, she writes. The terrible complex dilemmas. We can't fix everything. Now hear me, please. What she is offering us here, I say, is not a cry of despair. This is a real question she's asking. What rouses us finally? To which she offers a real answer. We can't fix everything. In fact, her plainly worded statement is exactly what I mean when I say that social justice work without a spiritual center moves toward either guilt-ridden self-congratulation or the self-righteous shaming of others, and way too quickly. Remember the beginning of Lohman's poem? Returning from a peace march in front of the federal building, she writes, Slamming into us, the wind pushed our placards off the iron railing outside the federal building. Wanting words I could stand by, these made me uneasy, a strident, facile blame, the public appeal to guilt. No, social justice work, peace work, after a decade of tone-deaf national leadership, is not finding words that make us uneasy and flinging them at folks in anger and trying to drum up their sense of guilt. To work for peace or economic access, honestly, in our age, which is different than the Vietnam age in a thousand ways, is to begin by admitting that many things will simply not get done by us, and that that has to be okay. Others may get them done, but we have to trust them to do it and cannot shoulder everything ourselves. It's to do the work and not blame others for not being roused by the same thing that rouses us, as if our understandings could or should be universal. To work honestly for peace and economic justice in our era is to admit real limits and real boundaries and not feel like we are failures just because we are human and cannot topple regimes with letters and marches planned 2 weeks in advance. It's to admit that we will never have control over all the injustices of the world, even if we try with all our might, give up all of our sleep, and never take our children to soccer practice again so we can spend all of our time working on issues, and issues, the issues which rouse us. To approach social justice work of any kind with a spiritual grounding is to admit to not being omnipotent. It's to take seriously that human beings are not stand-ins for some miracle-working God. It's to not live with panic, but with steadfastness of purpose without sacrificing daily devotion to our families and our friends and the personal needs of body and spirit. In the end, whether or not we march or sing songs or meet 300 strong at a bread meeting may not be for the making of peace or the establishment of a socially just world, as if by magic. The marching and the singing may be more important as strengthening for our own spirits, so we don't despair, don't forget our power as limited as it is. Cultivate our steady patience. Don't give up, give in, wear out. Maybe, as is often true, our children's story offers us the best clue about this month's theme. In Peace Week in Miss Fox's class, the students learn that wanting peace means that they themselves have to act peacefully. No name calling, no throwing things, no sarcasm, no revenge, no blaming others, no quick reactions, no self-righteousness, no we're the good guys, and if only everyone was just like us, the world would be a better place. None of that. By shouldering responsibility for the only persons we can be responsible for, ourselves, we spiritually prepare ourselves to move peace issues forward in the world. Whether we sing and march again as once we did, or push forward on the social organization level with bread or results, or whether we work for peace by cooking or bringing food for the hungry, it's important to remember that it's all worthwhile, both for ourselves and for the world of our lives. There is no competition. There is no one size fits all. And no matter what color the onion is, the broth will always be better for it. So I am grateful for the observation that prompted this sermon. It made me think a bit. I hope it made you think a bit. And maybe it might even serve to begin to clarify what really rouses you, so you can decide just what compelling, understandably limited, but powerful thing it is that you want to do next.